Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to our Burma correspondent, Edith Mirante, to talk about what's happened after the cyclone that devastated Burma. Now, right now, I would like to welcome the wonderful folks from the Teen Court of Santa Fe County. Alice Seeley is here. She's the program manager. Jennifer Romero is administrative assistant. And Amanda Rabe is teen attorney, just graduated from high school. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi.
Thank you.
Hi. It's good to have you all here. First of all, Teen Court. We had you on, Alice, a few years ago talking about what it is. But for those who didn't hear that program, give us a reminder. What is Teen Court?
Well, Teen Court is a way for teens that get in trouble to get out of trouble. And what we do, it's an alternative sentencing program. And they come to Teen Court, and Teen Court is run for teens by teens. Amanda Rabe is one of the teen attorneys that helps to run the program. And what happens is they come to court, there's a teen jury, and the teen jury decides their sentence. The sentence always includes community service, giving back to the community, and it always includes jury duty, so they serve on the jury for other teens. It's also mandatory that they take a DWI prevention class, because part of our funding comes from DWI funding, and it's also something we want to help prevent. And
so whether or not their offense, whether that their misdemeanor had to do with DWI, they have to take a DWI prevention class.
Exactly. And they often ask that question, too. Like, why do I have to take the DWI class? And it's just for everyone. But then we also have about 15 other program components for other offenses. And they're all quite interesting and different and suited to fit the various offenses.
Jennifer, what kind of problems or bad things do the teenagers do that they have to come in, that they end up coming into teen court?
Well, we have a wide variety. We get referrals from traffic, municipal court, magistrate court, so like any type of traffic violation. And we also get misdemeanors. So from speeding to possession of marijuana under the influence, those are two biggest misdemeanors under the influence of alcohol and probably possession and under the influence of marijuana.
And so they get picked up, let's say, by the cops. What happens then? Do they go straight to teen court? Do they spend the night in jail? Do their parents come and carry on? I mean,
well, usually not, since it's a first time offenders program. It's to keep them out of the system. So they get caught, you know, by the police or at school, instead of making a record for them and sending them to jail, they're referred to us. So a police report is made, it's sent to juvenile probation, and juvenile probation then makes the decision if it's something minor, if they haven't been in trouble again, to refer to us. And then we take it from there. We have a meeting with them. We go over their story, because teen court, we want to hear the teen's voice and their side of the story as well.
How does their side of the story sometimes differ from, let's say, the police side of the story?
Well, they always have their, I don't want to say excuse, but
minimizing tactics.
Yeah. To just add in, I do want to say that teen court is for teens that admit guilt. So in order to go through the program, you have to be guilty, and you have to take responsibility for that. So they get their side of the story, they say what they need to say, but in the end, they are accepting responsibility for what they did.
Now, how, Amanda, did you get into teen court?
My mother knew Alice Seeley, and I used to think I wanted to be a lawyer, so I thought it would be great experience for me, and it has been great experience. It's really helped my public speaking skills, helps you think on your feet quickly. It's really a fun program, because you get to interact with your peers and all sorts of stuff and hear the crazy excuses kids come up with sometimes.
What are some of those?
Well, you know, it'll be like a speeding case, and they'll be like, oh, I didn't realize I was going 30 miles over the speed limit. Like, oh yes, come on. Like, or, oh, I just took off my seatbelt for like 2 seconds to reach back and then the cop pulled me over. Like,
yeah, right.
Things like that. Or,
yeah, I know some adults who think that way too.
Oh yeah.
So you, it wasn't that you went through the program yourself.
That's right. No, I just started working with Teen Court. I volunteered for 9 months of the school year. And then during the summer, they added a paid incentive for me. So that's always nice.
And so what are your duties actually as teen attorney?
Well, during misdemeanor nights, me and another teen attorney will interview a client, a defendant, hear their side of the story, figure out what kind of case we're going to make for them. And then court happens. They go on to trial. The attorneys make opening statements for defense and for prosecution. Then we question our defendant on the stand in front of the jury and get their story out in front of the jury and try and present it in the best light possible and then make closing statements and ask the jury for, as a defense attorney, minimum sentence. And as a prosecuting attorney, you'd ask for the maximum sentence.
Now, if they've already admitted their guilt, why are you going through this whole process?
Well, some people need a little bit more corrective help than others. You know, some people really have a lot of remorse for what they've done and have honestly, like, switched up their ways. Other people still have dirty UAs coming into teen court.
Dirty what?
Urine analysis. They fail drug tests even after they've been charged for possession. Those people maybe deserve the maximum sentence as opposed to somebody who really has stopped using and only needs the minimum sentence.
What kind of sentences do they then give?
Well, for a minor possession case, you're looking at between 30 to 50 hours of community service and 4 to 6 nights of jury duty. And we offer a lot of different places where you can do your community service around town.
So what kind, like, for example, what kind of community service might they end up doing?
Well, a lot of kids choose to work at, like, the Chavez Center or something like that, where, you know, they just put them to work and don't pay them, obviously. Where are some other places that we...
Well, we like to try to get them to go to community service places that they're actually doing a real community service, as far as going to the nursing homes, because there's a lot of elderly that don't get visitors. And, I mean, just by a teen going in and reading a book to them or visiting with them, it's really good community service. So we try to push those ones as much as we can. Other places, Salvation Army.
Kitchen Angels, too.
Kitchen Angels. Yeah, so...
Do you get reports from young people who've done community service who are actually affected by it on some heart level, emotional level?
Yes, we do, actually. We get teens that actually stay on at the agency where they did their community service because they like it or the agency likes them. Often what we try to do is to find an agency that is connected to the offense. So one of the agencies we use is called Impact DWI, where we actually send teens to help them, to help prevent DWI. We also have a graffiti cleanup program. So anyone who has committed the offense of graffiti will be working cleaning up graffiti.
Oh, boy.
So as much as possible.
That must be annoying for them.
Well, they can then get to see, you know, it's no big deal when you write your name on a wall, but cleaning your name off the wall is a whole different story. So we like them to really see and feel what that means.
And above all, how it affects other people. It feels a little bit like restorative justice.
Well, we have a restorative justice component in our program. We actually sentence people to restorative justice circles, and our shoplifting program is now exactly that. It is a restorative justice circle that is run by Mary Louise Romero. So it's quite exciting. We've really gotten into restorative justice, and it's a very, very new and exciting field.
Do you feel like it works?
I absolutely feel like it works, yes. I feel like it gets people thinking about what they did and who it affects and how they can make it right.
We're talking to the folks from Teen Court of Santa Fe County. Now, this program's been going on for, I think, 14 years.
Yeah, I think it's just about 14 or 15. Yeah, it's about 14 years. You're right.
And
that's good.
Yeah, and which means that at least some of the people in
who have participated in teen court are old enough to themselves have become attorneys or gone on in law enforcement. Do you see any of the people coming back?
I see them all the time. I see them everywhere. They're like little tentacles into the community. It's everywhere I go, I run into people. They're now in their, you know, there's some of them are still teens, older teens. Some are in their 20s. And, of course, even they could be 30 now, which makes me really old.
And do you feel like they have, because you've been doing it from the beginning, do you feel like they have been affected by their experience in teen court and come back and talk to you about it?
I see them, and they are really excited to see me, and they always say great things. So it makes me feel like they have gotten a lot out of it. So I believe they have, and they do. Not all of them, but many. We have good success.
Are there some crimes that are maybe so bad that teen court doesn't take care of them that are on another level?
Yes. We don't accept any felonies, so just misdemeanors. Anything, I mean, I think the most serious cases that we've seen are trafficking marijuana or
sometimes
cocaine.
Some bad battery cases will come through, too.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, we've seen, big group fights from Santa Fe High or things like that where there's more than four or five kids involved all at once.
And how do you deal with those? I would think at a certain point that'd be a little scarier. You'd feel like, gee, is this out of my league?
Yeah, I mean, I remember one of my second or third case, I was a prosecutor on a battery case like that. I was scared to prosecute this kid, man. I figured I was going to see him at school later. Actually, it's never really that bad, because in the court setting, everybody has a lot of respect for each other, and it just, you're able to get the story out as cleanly as possible. Of course, each person in that sort of circumstance has their own spin on the story, and he said this, I did that, no, I didn't hit him first, he hit, or, you know. But it's nice to be able to hear multiple sides of the story sometimes, because then it's not so biased one way or the other.
Let me just add that those are the cases that go to the restorative justice circle. They lend themselves to that circle, and it's what's amazing about it is how it completely turns around how they feel about themselves and how they feel about each other.
So really, I mean, it's probably most of the people are better off having gone through this process than if they hadn't been caught in the first place.
We like to think so. As a matter of fact, very often that is the case, and we actually say that to people. When the teen first comes in for their meeting, they come with their family, their parents, and at that time it's often a real opening of communication between the teen and the parent and us, and it can really change lives.
What kind of participation do you have from the parents? Do you have parents who are pretty defensive about their children or maybe who maybe neglect their children? Or
occasionally we do, but teen court can often change that and turn it around. So, I mean, they're required to participate, the parents. So they participate. Sometimes they're very defensive. Sometimes they, you know, when you were asking about strange excuses, I had a parent once say to me, my teen had their hand out and someone put marijuana in it.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was my favorite.
Yeah, I was there.
I had my mouth open and somebody poured a martini.
Yeah,
in.
Exactly. So
very interesting. So, Amanda, you were saying a moment ago that you thought at one point that you wanted to go into law, you wanted to be an attorney. Has this made you feel that more that you do or that you don't?
Like I said, I've really enjoyed the experience and everything. Although I'm not sure I'd want to be an attorney, just because sometimes between me and the other attorneys, it just gets really like competitive and edgy, and you just really want to win the case for the sake of winning it, and not necessarily for the kid's better. For him being better off, you know,
right.
As a prosecutor, even if you don't think he deserves the maximum, you're pretty much forced to ask for the maximum in contrast to your defense attorney.
Very interesting.
And also, teen court's different than regular court because it's just a sentencing court. So, you know, maybe it'd be different if I was in a case where you actually get to question whether or not they are guilty. But for me, it was a little bit discouraging to see some people, for a speeding case or something get more hours than somebody who had a possession charge or something.
So you're exposed to the injustice of the system in microcosm right at a tender age.
Yeah, but again, you know, it's been a great experience. I've met some of the attorneys in town. Carl Summers has been a great influence for me. We also had the county clerk in once to be our judge.
Oh, great.
Yeah, what was her name again?
You're talking about Virginia Vigo, and we've had Steve Ross from the county.
We've also had Mayor Koss be the judge before.
Yes.
Sarah Bennett.
So right. It's been great exposure to a lot of people, great networking and stuff.
Now, one of the things that the teens have to do sometimes is write a letter of apology. What are some examples where you've seen students actually have to write those letters?
So that's, again, going through the restorative justice. They talk about what they had to go through, what they did affected other people. A lot of times I usually read them, if not one of the other staff do. And I hear a lot that they're apologizing to their parents for doing what they did, and they're really remorseful, and it's good to see that and to see how they understand how it's affected their parents. And they're asking their parents to gain trust in them again, and that's really good.
Alice, looking at the system, and now you've been doing it for quite some time, what are the most common recurring problems that misdemeanors that teens are actually engaging in?
Well, actually, substance abuse is the largest problem, and alcohol and marijuana are the largest substances that people are using, and I would say marijuana is even larger than alcohol because it is illegal, which makes it easier to get.
And ironically.
Yeah, and it damages their brains. And in fact, we have a program called Family Night, which is presented by Tim Burns on how substances affect the growing brain. And it's, you know, I used to, before I had this job, I used to think, well, it's no big deal if they do a little of this or a little of that, but it's not true. It is a big deal. It's a really big deal, because if you start using any of these substances at a young age, it's going to affect your brain permanently.
Young being
14, 15, or 16, before your brain's fully developed, and that's not until your early 20s.
Actually, ooh. 25 now.
25
yeah.
now?
New
See
research.
How behind the times I am? Yeah.
Which means, Alice, with great respect, that none of us should be functional.
Well, I'm not under 25. I don't know about you.
No, I'm not either, but we all did. I mean, you know, when I was young, everybody drank.
Well, what happens is it affects your brain to a certain extent, depending on how much you used and how much of a time period you had of not using. So some of us didn't use at a young age, and some of us that did have then given it up for such a long time that they're able to get that.
We got a few brain cells back that actually grew back.
Right, and the other thing is that if you start drinking before the age of 15, like around 14, you have a much greater chance of becoming an alcoholic in life. So that's a really scary statistic. And it's, you know, I mean, if you've ever been under the influence, you know how hard it is to study, drive, or do anything. And that's the problem. It's really, it can affect your whole life.
You also have a program which is a reality program where students visit the Youth Detention Center.
Yeah, do you want
to? Yeah, actually, I go in with the teens once a month to the Youth Detention Center on Airport Road, and we kind of give them a walkthrough. It used to be the Scared Straight program, but research has shown that scare tactics do not work, so we don't go that route anymore. We do a walkthrough. We let them speak to other inmates and just give them an idea of what it would be like or what the end of the road is if they continue to do what they're doing.
Now, Amanda, you just graduated from Desert Academy.
That's
and
true.
You have an quite unusual idea of how to raise funds to go to college.
Yeah, I got accepted to Wellesley, which is an all-girls school just outside of Boston. It's very expensive. I'm looking at paying about $50,000 a year for tuition.
Good heavens.
Not to mention the cost of living in Boston, in that area. So I've started a website. It's helpamandagettocollege.info, and I'm asking my friends and family members to donate as little as $10, and more importantly, to ask 10 of their friends and family members to contribute as well. And my goal is to reach 10,000 people, because if I do that, I will have paid for 2 years of college.
And what's the website again?
HelpAmandaGetToCollege.info. All one word.
Okay, well, it's been wonderful having you all on the air. Amanda Rabe is a teen attorney, Jennifer Romero is administrative assistant, and Alice Seeley is program manager of the Teen Court of Santa Fe. And you can actually find that on the web at santafecounty.org/teencourt. And anything else you want to add before we go?
Yeah, I would like to add that we're looking for teen attorneys for next year. And if there's anyone out there who's interested in working at Teen Court, please call us at 995-9555.
Well, that's easy. 995-9555. Thank you all so much for being here
with
us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. We will be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Edith Mirante. She joins us by telephone. She's the director of Project Maji, a human rights project for Burma, and the author of Burmese Looking Glass and Down the Rat Hole. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
Now, we've had you on the air a couple of times before talking about Burma, the country also known as Myanmar, and for the purposes of simplicity, we are calling it Burma. Is that correct?
Sure. The regime in Burma changed its name, one of the many things that it does without asking the people of Burma. So the democracy movement still does go with the word Burma.
So let's talk about the cyclone that happened in May. It devastated the country. It was considered the worst natural disaster in the country's entire history. Why was it so bad? What actually happened?
Well, it was something that had never struck Burma before. Cyclones are really just hurricanes, the same as Hurricane Katrina. And they are common in the Indian Ocean, where that coast of Burma is. But in the past, they've hit Bangladesh, they've hit India, but not really Burma. In the case of Burma, there was no warning for the people who lived in the path of the storm, even though the Indian Weather Service had told the regime of Burma that it was on its way. In fact, a friend of mine said that the weather report the day before just said 80% chance of rain, not 80% chance of 120-mile-an-hour winds that would just sweep right into the country. And the place where it hit hardest was a delta region. Again, it's reminiscent of the whole Louisiana-Mississippi situation in our own country. Farming, fertile, flat, low region, just like the Mississippi Delta. And the people there were completely vulnerable to a 12-foot surge of water that just inundated the entire area. If you look at the satellite photos, it's just unbelievable devastation that struck that entire area. So a combination of people not having a chance to get out of the way of it, not having prior warning, which is what they do in Bangladesh these days. They really go from village to village to let people know, get to higher ground or get to a sturdy concrete building. And just the places where they were living and just trying to farm rice were absolutely hit just as hard as could possibly be. So now the casualties are estimated of probably over 100,000 people dead and another 2 million survivors just struggling to make it almost 2 months later.
Is that number so high because of what happened on the day of or the diseases and other things that have happened in the aftermath?
It really came right during the storm. A lot of children were just basically swept out to sea. People tried to tie themselves to trees or house posts or anything they could as the wind and the water swept in. Since then, there hasn't been a huge epidemic sweeping through the area, but at the same time, there are still whole vast tracts of it that no outside relief has reached. So doubtless the casualties have been higher in those regions that are further out towards the ocean. What was unfortunate was that right after the storm hit, there were offers of boats and all kinds of ways to get aid in from the sea to those places that were most vulnerable, but they were rejected by the regime. Everything had to go through them, which meant to their airport and then down to the Delta. So it really slowed things up to the extent that we still don't have any contact with a lot of the storm hit area.
So as we know, Burma's government is a military dictatorship, and the horror of this story is the way in which the people have been treated and the way they reacted after the storm. Tell us about that whole thing.
Well, it's horror, and there's also kind of a good side to it. I mean, part of it is that the people who sought help from the storm, even just standing on the side of the road trying to get help from anybody, were basically beaten back down to the mud that they came out of. They've been sent back to what's left of their villages, not been allowed to congregate in any kind of storm victim camps or anything where they might get aid on a more consistent basis. The good part is that even though a huge international aid effort was kept out, the people of Burma themselves really rose to the occasion. And this is a country, you know, under a military dictatorship since 1962. So civil society and grassroots organization and all of those things are big no-nos in Burma. However, somehow they really organized whatever they could in the way of food aid, in the way of water purification, and got that down to the Delta region from the biggest city, Rangoon. And a lot of this used a network of the Buddhist monks who are just ubiquitous throughout Burma. You may remember what they called the Saffron Revolution last fall, when the monks marched in the streets of the cities and just chanted prayers of compassion, not only for Burma, but for all humanity. That so-called revolution was met with bullets by the regime and just brutally suppressed. But the monks that have survived that were really instrumental and amazing in getting just crucial emergency relief down to the Delta. Sometimes it would be international groups that would get the funds to the monks and they would distribute it, or even just collecting any spare clothes, any spare rice from people around Burma itself, which is a terribly, terribly poor country.
I find it just amazingly ironic that a country that is so Buddhist, what is it, 80% Buddhist, which is a religion of compassionate practice and meditation, can have such a brutal military dictatorship.
Well, some people say that the meditation practices like Vipassana, which originated in Burma, are the only thing that enables many people to survive the dictatorship at all.
Right.
That they are able to endure so much because they also have a slightly different grip on reality through their meditation practice. We do know that Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate who has been imprisoned under house arrest for many, many years in Burma, has credited the meditation practice with being able to endure that incredible ordeal. In fact, she's now in her fifth year of house arrest and just celebrated, if you can call it that, her 63rd birthday in that condition.
So what has been the fate of people who have tried to give aid from outside of Burma? In other words, I know that there are international aid individuals and agencies who've had a really hard time with that.
There were luckily a few agencies which already had contracted and had permission from the regime to operate their projects in the Delta region itself, and that included the Dutch branch of Médecins Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders, and a British medical group called Merlin, like the magician. And so through them, other aid agencies were able to channel funds and assistance. So that was a big lifeline. And Avaaz.org, they're kind of the international Move On. They have done a lot through monk networks, just getting the funding in. It's really sad that there is a country in the world where you have to smuggle in water purification tablets. But if that's what it takes, that's what's being done in Burma.
You actually experienced a cyclone yourself in Bangladesh. Was it comparable to the one in Burma?
It was very comparable. That was in 1991, and 139,000 people were killed in that one night. I happened to be on the seacoast of Bangladesh in the place where the storm hit the first, and it really was like a hurricane. I mean, I've been in hurricanes, so I knew what it felt like. It was like a rough, rough hurricane, which in the United States will affect people, as we saw in Katrina. But in Bangladesh, even more so, because people were living on very flat land, islands off the coast, just any scrap of land that they could find to grow rice and raise a family on. The Bangladesh government, ever since then, has taken every possible step to prevent a repeat of the effects. And now they have, as I said, the village warning systems. They have shelters. And when a cyclone hits in Bangladesh now, maybe a few thousand people were killed, not a huge cataclysm like happened in 1991. And other countries have learned from it somewhat, but then as we saw in Burma, it's just a perfect storm sometimes of the politics and the economics and the weather. And as we've seen in this country, same syndrome.
You would think that after the suppression of the Buddhist monks last year that the Burmese government would be falling all over themselves to do something right and to get good PR in world opinion.
They're just not that kind of people, actually. They only really care about world opinion when it involves petroleum multinationals. And a lot of people characterize them as xenophobic or isolationist. But in reality, they have nice, tight partnerships with big oil companies like Total and Chevron from the United States. And this regime makes $150 million a month off of petroleum. They have $4 billion worth of foreign exchange reserves from petroleum sales. So they get to kind of pick and choose. They're going to do whatever they want. The UN is not intervening in Burma by force, what's called humanitarian intervention, generally because it's prevented from doing so by China and Russia, who believe that what you do within your own borders stays within your own borders. And so they have enough protection between their China relationship and their Total Chevron relationship to not really care about things like how good they look in the eyes of the world.
Has there been any activism on the part of, European or United States citizens against companies like Chevron who are doing business with this regime?
There were demonstrations at Chevron's shareholder meeting this year, not only on behalf of people of Burma, but also Latin America and other places where they operate in Africa. Right now, there is a bill in Congress that had been introduced by Congressman Lantos just before he died, and it would remove the tax credit that Chevron gets from the U.S. government for operating in Burma. I know it might seem like it's a bit odd that we are giving them tax credit for that sort of thing when we do have sanctions on every other company that was in Burma. But sure enough, there we are enabling Chevron to continue in business there.
Tell us more about United States policy toward Burma. It seems like it has the right hand doesn't quite know what the left is doing, or is that not the case?
Well, we're a little bit good cop, bad cop with Burma, as we are in many other places. And so you'll have Laura Bush standing up and giving actually very well-informed very hard-hitting comments about the regime in Burma. And then on the other hand, still enabling one of the very biggest direct partners of the regime to continue there. Both candidates in the upcoming presidential election are very firm supporters of a free Burma. John McCain has been there a few times, and Senator Obama has issued a very thoughtful and proactive statements on the event there. So it's a very bipartisan issue in that case. Governor Bill Richardson from New Mexico, I would say, is probably the longest-running, strongest supporter of the Free Burma cause. So that I can think of. I remember actually meeting with him for an hour back in the 1980s on Burma when nobody had heard of this issue or cared about it. And he has been over there and met. He was one of the very few people to meet with Aung San Suu Kyi when she was allowed out of house arrest the first time.
We're speaking with Edith Mirante. So what happens now in terms of food? I mean, part of a large part of the devastated area after the cyclone was rice-growing areas. Are there food shortages? Are there rice shortages?
Well, there's food and rice shortages throughout the world right now. Even now, if you go to Costco, they'll limit your bags of rice that you take home with you every day for a variety of reasons, some involving biofuel and some involving the erosion of farmland in general. But there's definitely a huge rice shortage in Asia. And this area of Burma was the biggest rice producer by far in Burma. So it's just been devastated, really inundated with salt water, and the buffaloes used to plow the crops are gone, and it's going to be very, very hard to recover that at all. The regime in Burma will doubtless be asking for more and more rice donations from the world. The irony of this is that they just exported tons of rice to Sri Lanka, again, to get this hard currency that they are always in need of because they've got a very big army in Burma. So it reminds me of nothing but the Irish potato famine when England was exporting food out of Ireland and the Irish were starving. Right now, at the very, very same time after the cyclone hit, the regime of Burma still exported rice from the country to get money.
They've got this huge petroleum deal going on, and they still don't have hard currency?
They seem to want more. They have an army almost a third the size of the U.S. Army, and that's what they spend their money on.
That's huge.
You could call it that, but it works for them. They've been in power since 1962, and they haven't fought a war with anybody else. This is all for internal use only.
What's the relationship between Burma and the other countries in the region?
It's generally fairly cozy with their neighbors. As I mentioned, China supplies those weapons to that big army and also has really logged the forests of Burma just to shreds to supply its own furniture industry. India is a great big democracy, but just like us, is very interested in petroleum deals with the regime, and likewise Thailand, also a democracy, also in petroleum. So it's all, you know, very Syriana, because whatever political goals anybody has are constantly being undercut by this petroleum thirst of the world.
You said a moment ago that they have this gigantic army that's a third the size of the United States Army, and it's all used internally. What does that mean? What does that look like? It's just repressing their own people?
It's repressing their own people, as we saw with the monks being cracked down upon in the cities. It's there as a deterrent against them. The regime itself are all elderly military men who just believe the more power they have through the military, the better. And it's also actively used in warfare in many of the frontier areas. Back when I started doing this work in the 1980s, there was a really active insurgency in those areas, a rebellion of particularly different ethnic groups against the regime. That has really waned in recent years. It's pretty hard to face down, you know, that many troops from the government, but they are still, even as the relief planes were landing and being unloaded by soldiers of that army, other units of the army were fighting against the ethnic minority civilians in those areas. So it's quite an ethnic cleansing situation. Some people call it Asia's Darfur.
And it's a situation that, I mean, I guess it's better known since last year, the Saffron Revolution, but it really has not had that much attention in the world media, if I'm correct.
Well, yeah, one always wants more attention. Unfortunately, the cyclone brought it, Burma, the most attention ever in the most horrible way that you would never, ever wish on a country. It's sort of just when you thought things couldn't get any worse, that happened to Burma. And they really discouraged media coverage. I just got a report today of a local reporter from Burma. Those are really brave people who got arrested just because she covered a gathering of people who were trying to get help from a relief organization, and she's in jail now. Several journalists have been kicked out just trying to cover the cyclone situation, including a BBC reporter and other ones to have dreadful tales of being smuggled down to the Delta in little boats and nearly getting caught doing it. The way that information gets out of Burma still is really impressive. There is cell phone video that hit YouTube of the monks' demonstrations and just the few pictures that we managed to get out from the cyclone area. Those, again, are very brave local people that managed to do it. Internet access is very much government-controlled in Burma. They own the server. Right. But there's always, you know, a few 14-year-olds who can figure out a way around that. So information does manage to still get out of there.
Thank goodness for teenage nerds. There's also a unbelievably a hip-hop scene in Burma and suppression of that on the part of the government.
Yeah, it's the last place on earth, isn't it, that you would expect to have a hip-hop scene. But yeah. Sure enough, they've got one. It's fairly underground these days because some of the best rappers there have been arrested, and they're doing their time now. One was a guy named G-Tone, and he got up at a concert and took his shirt off, and on his back was tattooed not Thug Life like Tupac Shakur, but actually just a picture of a Buddhist monk's hands clasped in prayer. And that alone got him dragged off the stage and put in prison, where he's been ever since, just for carrying a reference to the Buddhist monk's alternative to militarism. And another rapper named Zaire Thaw got arrested recently, and not only the pop music scene, but there's a poet there named Kosal Y, and he's been in jail for months because he published a poem on Valentine's Day which had a subversive reference to the big top junta dictator General Fan Shui in the poem. So it is a country where poetry can get you in real trouble.
And they put these people in a prison which you really would not want to go to. It's called, amazingly enough, the Insane Prison.
Yeah, it's a terrible place. And in fact, during the cyclone itself, the roof blew off of one of the cell blocks. And the prisoners tried to get out. And it sounds like several dozen of them, according to reports that came out at the time, were shot right then and there for just trying to escape the exposure to the storm, which is one small aspect of the many, many people who died that night and that day, but still a terrible one.
So we have a military dictatorship with a lot of money through petroleum deals that doesn't care a hoot about public opinion or world opinion. What, if anything, and revolutions are brutally put down, people are put in prison, you can't even do poetry, what, if anything, is to be done?
Well, less international support, of course, which means the oil companies would certainly be a good idea. Less support from China. So a lot of what's done internationally is trying to pressure China, and also India, for that matter, to not be so supportive of the dictatorship in Burma. And constantly moral support for the Buddhist monks, for the poets, for the rappers, the people who are in prison in Burma, constant awareness of what they're going through. A very significant date this year will be August 8th, 2008. Well, it's the beginning of the Olympics in China, but for Burma, it means the 20-year anniversary of a huge pro-democracy uprising in 1988. And the high point of that was August 8th, so it's 8888. Numbers are very important in Burma. People are into numerology very much there and astrology. So we should watch that country very carefully for what happens in and around that date, too. and really have them in our thoughts, our prayers, our meditations on that day.
You are the director of Project Maji. Tell us about what you do.
Well, back in the mid-1980s, I was in Thailand. I just went there to hang out and eat Thai food and paint pictures and enjoy the Southeast Asian culture. And I just happened to cross over the border into the war zone of Burma, which I didn't know about, and Americans certainly didn't know about back then. And that's why my books have these Lewis Carroll kind of titles, Burmese Looking Glass Down the Rat Hole, because it really was going through another world for me completely. And ever since then, my job has just been to get Americans to know what was going on inside Burma. So I distribute information, particularly on human rights and environmental issues that affect the country.
Edith Mirante is the director of Project Maji, and that's on the net at Project Maji, MAJE.org, and the author of a couple of books, and has spoken to us on a fairly regular basis over the years about Burma. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I wish I was there in person right now, but it's always nice to talk to you.
Well, we hope to see you in person one of these days as well. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can leave a message at radiocafe@ksfr.org or call at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz. And tomorrow, Friday, Robert Knott will be with us, speaking of the arts, and much, much more on KSFR, which is Santa Fe's only public radio station, and we will see you soon. Ciao.